Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, Dr. Alyssa Watson, and today I'm joined by Dr. Katie Bennett, a board-certified specialist in veterinary anesthesia and analgesia. Dr. Bennett currently practices at the Veterinary Specialty Center in Buffalo Grove, Illinois, and one of her passions is loco-regional analgesia, which is what we're going to be discussing today. You can find Dr. Bennett's most recent Clinician's Brief article entitled Loco-Regional Anesthesia Complications in the January-February 2022 edition of Clinician's Brief. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Bennett. Before we jump in, could you just take a minute to introduce yourself to the audience?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to chat with you today. So I am, like you said, an anesthesiologist at VSC in Buffalo Grove. We're just outside of Chicago. We're quite a large specialty hospital. I did my undergrad and vet school training at Purdue University and my internship at Washington State University and then my residency at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. And then I headed straight to VSC right after I finished my residency. But I have a lot of passions in my job, one of them being local regional anesthesia. But I also really love working with aggressive animals and specifically patients that are very difficult in the hospital. Local anesthesia really actually helps those guys a lot, and we can talk about that later. But besides that, I also really enjoy education, both for general practitioners, other specialists, but also the other parts of the veterinary staff that keep us going every single day. So the technical staff, technicians, tech assistants, you know, everybody that kind of is involved in the team, I think is really important. And I love being able to bring them, you know, new knowledge and new facts to kind of round out their experience while they're working alongside me in the hospital.
That's wonderful. We're really excited to have you here today to have this discussion. And I'm very interested in that little teaser about, especially, you know, working with animals in the hospital that, you know, are a little bit difficult, because we all know we want to do the best that we can with relieving these animals' anxiety and pain. And so I'm excited to find out how locals can help us do that. So let's talk for a second about the important role that local anesthetics play in balanced analgesia protocols. So just going back for everybody, just a little refresher, how do local anesthetics, you know, work to block nerve impulses?
So our typical local anesthetics are what they call sodium channel blockers. So they actually work on the sodium channels that are located in the nerve fibers. They're also located in other areas of the body too, like the gastrointestinal system or the heart. And some local anesthetics can have effects on both of those. But typically they bind to the sodium channel and they either move through the cell membrane. So they have that lipophilic compound where they can move through the fatty part of the cell membrane and get into the cell, or they can actually move through the open channel. So when the sodium channel opens, when a nerve impulse is conducted, that local anesthetic can actually move through that open channel and then bind to a receptor inside the cell to block that sodium channel. So they actually bind, you know, not outside the cell membrane, not around the nerve. They actually have to go inside the nerve in order to block that sodium channel from propagating further impulses. So that's kind of where the theory that the more a nerve is stimulated, the faster it will block, because it allows those channels to open a lot more and allows that local anesthetic more opportunities to move through and get on the inside of the cell to go ahead and block the impulse.
That makes sense. Thank you for that insight. You know, there's different routes of administration of these local anesthetics. So, you know, we can use them topically, we can infiltrate like you were talking about, or even give them systemically. Does how you're giving it, does that change the mechanism of action, or do they all still work the same?
They all still work pretty much the same. The efficacy and degree of efficacy does have a little bit to do with how you administer that drug. So, for example, administering something as a splash block or topically, you aren't kind of giving it in a very concentrated spot. And so to work the best, they actually have to block, we're going to go all the way back to like first year vet school physiology. They have to block three nodes of Ranvier. So those spaces between the myelin on the nerve, that is where that nerve impulse travels, right, from node to node to node. They have to actually block three in a row for that entire nerve signal pathway to be completely interrupted. And so that blocking is going to depend on the type of nerve, how much myelin is in there, how big the nerve is, and how much local anesthetic it's exposed to. So if you're not going to give enough volume to cover all of that space, you are not going to effectively block that nerve. So depending on the type of block that you're doing, the type of local anesthetic that you're administering, and again, the route of administration is going to change the efficacy of your block, but it doesn't have a lot to do with how the drug works. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That makes sense. That was perfect.
Yeah.
So what are the most common local anesthetics that you're using, you know, in practice?
So right now, the two common ones that I use are lidocaine and bupivacaine. So lidocaine is the original, and like the very, very, very first local anesthetic is actually cocaine, but it works the same way. But they, and they still have medical grade cocaine now in human hospitals for nasal surgery. But lidocaine is probably the most common, the most useful. It's super, super inexpensive. I don't know that there is a less expensive drug for your bang for your buck on the market right now. And it is pretty easy to use, but it doesn't last as long as bupivacaine. So bupivacaine I typically use for a majority of my blocks just for duration of action. And then this is kind of outside the scope of what we'll talk about today, but I would also consider Noceta, so the liposome encapsulated bupivacaine, another local anesthetic, but the mechanism of action is slightly different in that, in how it lasts longer and so forth. So most commonly, lidocaine and bupivacaine are the two that I use in practice. So, and that's pretty common across the board.
Yeah, absolutely.
For most people.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask you the question that seems to get a lot of debate and people have strong feelings about is mixing the two, because I have seen it go back and forth. I've been in practice. This is my 19th year in practice. And like for a while it was like, oh yeah, mix them. And then it was like, oh no, don't mix them. And now I'm hearing a little bit of whispers of mixing them again. So what's your opinion and why?
So like many drugs, local anesthetics do depend on pH and pKa. So the pH at which the drug is 50% ionized, 50% non-ionized, they depend on that for, you know, the best efficacy that they can provide. So mixing the two local anesthetics. So if you want to mix lidocaine and bupivacaine, in theory, it sounds great because lidocaine works faster, but bupivacaine lasts longer. So you're like, oh, maybe I can get the best of both worlds here. They did a study pretty recently and they looked at how that would actually work in tissues. And because of their differences in pKa and pH, they actually kind of lessen the efficacy of both of them. So they sort of not cancel each other out completely, but you don't get what you're expecting from that. You don't get a longer lasting but faster acting block. You kind of get something that is less reliable. There's not like a combination or a ratio that was looked at that was seemingly worthwhile to try to combine the two. Now, if they've changed that because they looked at a different ratio that, oh, well, if you do one part this to two parts that, it actually is more efficacious, but it does take effect faster. I would love to see that paper. But currently, what I typically tell people is if you want something to work very quickly and you don't need it for a long time, we're using lidocaine. If we want something to last longer and to provide analgesia for a longer period of time, and we have the patients to wait a little bit, we're using bupivacaine.
And when you say the patients to wait a little bit, how long do you mean? Do we need 15 minutes? We need 20 minutes?
That's a great question. So I actually consulted on a dentistry practice that was having a little bit of trouble with their patients under anesthesia. They would get all the x-rays done and everything, and they would find teeth that they would need to take out, and they would block them with bupivacaine and then start drilling, and the patients would wake up or be very light in terms of anesthetic depth. And it turns out that they weren't waiting long enough. So I try to tell people to wait at least 10 to 15 minutes before trying to do something painful in the area that you've blocked. Now, when I'm blocking things preoperatively, that's pretty easy because we prep the patient, we block them, we move them into the room, we get them draped in, you know, get all their monitoring stuff hooked up, et cetera, et cetera. And so by the time that the surgeon's ready to cut, that block has taken effect. Now, in dentistry, that's a little bit different. So we changed their protocol a little bit, and once the dentist actually blocked the teeth that they wanted to block, they did something else for 10 minutes and came back and then were able to take the teeth out and had far better anesthetic experiences that way. So I think it is important that you know, and anesthesia loves to take a dig here and there at a surgeon. So tell your surgeon to be patient. So whenever we need to wait a little bit longer for that block to take effect, it's definitely worthwhile because it provides such great MAC reduction. The patient is far more comfortable after anesthesia. And I think it's well worth the 10 or 15 minutes to wait.
Yeah, that's a perfect real world example. Thank you. So let's start to talk, move on a little bit and talk about, you know, some of these complications that you discussed in the article. One really significant risk of local regional anesthesia is systemic toxicosis. And it seems like cats are more susceptible to this complication. So do we know why cats are more sensitive than dogs?
Well, cats are, they're not small dogs. So for all my cat lovers out there, I know that. I'm very, you know, that is, they're very separate species. And I like to say that they can't metabolize their way out of a paper bag. So they are typically, they can get into it, but they can't get out. So they definitely do not metabolize and handle the local anesthetics like dogs can. And so I don't have like a perfect answer for you in terms of, oh, it's because of their CYP systems or anything like that, but they don't handle the systemic effects of local anesthetics as well as dogs do. And so their toxic dose is actually half of dogs. And so I'm pretty free with like rounding up, you know, in terms of mils when I give bupivacaine to a dog, but with a cat, like I am very, very adamant about not rounding. So we don't approach that toxic dose. So we have enough wiggle room in between what we're giving and what we shouldn't be giving. So they definitely will show clinical signs pretty quickly if you approach that toxic dose.
And you did mention bupivacaine, but this is a concern with lidocaine and other local anesthetics as well?
Yeah, it's a concern for all of them. And cats and dogs, we have to be extra careful with benzocaine. So the like oral gel that kids, for like teething kids or like a toothache or anything like that, that can actually cause life-threatening methemoglobinemia because of the benzocaine that's in there. So both cats and dogs are pretty sensitive to that. So keep that out of your pet's reach. That is a pretty significant toxicosis. But overall, I would say that cats are definitely more susceptible to systemic effects of both lidocaine and bupivacaine.
And you know, really detail very nicely in the article that we're looking at kind of these two major sets of complications, CNS complications and cardiac complications. So what are some clinical signs that we're having, you know, central nervous system toxicity?
That's a great question. So looking at what if you're worried about central nervous system toxicity, the biggest sign that I've seen clinically and that's reported in the literature is definitely things like tremors, muscle fasciculations, seizures, things that indicate like overall systemic neuro signs. So the patient is a little bit more dull. They can be a little ataxic, but the tremors are the number one that I've seen personally. They do sometimes get a little bit of GI, like vomiting, diarrhea signs, but most of that is probably due to, since the GI is the shock organ of the dog, if they're having a cardiac arrhythmia, like in the cardiac toxicity, that's probably more of a result from that. But yes, in CNS signs, we're looking at tremors, a little bit of mental dullness, but seizures, muscle fasciculations, stuff like that. That's going to be what you're really going to see.
Okay. How would you identify those if your patient's anesthetized? You know, we're not going to be really seeing ataxia or anything if they're under anesthesia.
Yeah, that's pretty tough. So, and unfortunately, you probably won't identify anything under anesthesia. If your patient is appropriately anesthetized, you won't see those tremors or muscle fasciculations. You'll probably start to see the arrhythmogenic effects of those local anesthetics. So things like cardiac toxicity, this is pretty profound, especially in bupivacaine toxicity. You'll see severe ventricular arrhythmias, everything from ventricular tachycardia to ventricular fibrillation. And that's when you start to get some serious side effects. And that's an emergency situation for sure.
And which do you think we see more commonly, cardiac toxicity or CNS toxicity? And is there one that usually presents first?
Yeah. So CNS toxicity typically presents first, of course, unless you're under anesthesia. So I would say that that happens usually first, but the problem is a lot of them have a pretty similar dose that'll cause both. So it's very possible that in your toxicity cases, you'll have a patient that's experiencing both types of toxicities. So you'll see CNS signs as well as cardiac arrhythmias. And so that's kind of the risk there with you know, that toxic dose that we talk about, you know, for dogs and cats, I try to stay below 75% of that, just so we don't approach that potential for overall systemic toxicity.
And what are some recommended treatments for patients that are experiencing, you know, clinical signs of systemic toxicosis?
That's a great question. So systemic toxicosis most of the time happens, you know, from accidental intravenous administration or, you know, significant uptake of, you know, that drug in that area. So the best thing is to, one, treat symptomatically to start. So things like supporting blood pressure, treating with antiarrhythmics. Obviously, if you're in VTAC and you have a local anesthetic toxicity, we shouldn't reach for lidocaine, just because I know that that's a first-line treatment for VTAC, but that's probably not what we want to use for a local anesthetic toxicity. It's easy to get into that habit of like, oh, that's what I need to use, but we just need to remember not to do that. So unfortunately, some of the antiarrhythmic medications that we would recommend are things like procainamide or even amiodarone. And amiodarone is not something that we typically have in a lot of general practices. But what you do sometimes have in general practices, or maybe in the ER down the street, is lipids. So intravenous lipid therapy is one of the best ways to treat the toxicity. So lipids will go ahead and bind those local anesthetics. Remember, I said that they have a, you know, a lipophilic part of their structure. And so they'll bind to those local anesthetics and then get them to come out of the system without causing additional toxicity, which is great.
So if we had that situation where you were talking about where, you know, they accidentally got a systemic dose of a local or something, and we know that they've had an overdose, do you wait to see if clinical signs of toxicity develop, or would you be calling the ER to get those lipids or, you know, get one of these other treatments on board right away?
So in terms of treating for arrhythmias, I would wait for arrhythmias to develop before I treat them, but I would go ahead and stabilize the patient, you know, make sure we're monitoring things like blood pressure, ECG. I would get lipids going as soon as possible. That's the best way to really get ahead of the potential for further toxicity. The more they metabolize that drug, the worse it's going to get. So if you know, the time is of the essence, typically, just because of those types of things.
And then I also wanted to ask you, because I know you had a case recently where this actually came up, are there specific instances, you know, where local anesthetics are completely contraindicated?
So not technically, in, you know, local anesthetics aren't usually contraindicated in patients, but the application of them, you know, can be. So recently I had a case of a greyhound that we know greyhounds can be hyperfibrinolytic, so they break down their clots pretty fast. I had this greyhound was actually on clopidogrel or Plavix, which is an antiplatelet drug for some strokes that he had had a couple years ago. He had a pathologic fracture in his hind leg. And so the question came up of, are we going to do an epidural for this fracture when we amputate the leg? So we're going to do a disarticulation at the hip joint. Are we going to risk doing an epidural? And so I weighed these pretty heavily. You know, I have a patient that breaks down clots fast just because he's a greyhound. And then he also has been on an antiplatelet drug and hasn't been off of it for long enough for it to be out of his system. So while his platelets may function okay right now, do I want to risk potentially inducing trauma to an area that I can't watch or make sure that we don't have any adverse effects? My concern was, you know, potentially if you hit a sinus when you're trying to do an epidural, even the best people who've performed blocks for a long, long time, you know, sometimes that happens. And the risk of putting a hematoma on the spinal cord was, in my opinion, too much to do that. So I actually went with a different type of local regional block using ultrasound and nerve stim to do a sacral plexus and a psoas compartment block instead. But just because those places are just a little bit less risky to induce hemorrhage if that happened in that patient, but also patients that have, you know, at the site of local injection, you know, a pyoderma, things that you're going to potentially spread like cancer, things that are going to really be a negative thing to poke a needle through. So anything you don't want to poke a needle through in general, probably don't want to try to put a needle in to block that.
That's a really good case that you bring up, is, and I know it's one that we have questions about all the time, is should, you know, if you have a mass that you think is cancerous or you're not sure, you know, how infiltrative it is, should you use a local block in those instances?
Yeah, if you can actually block away from that site. So For example, if you have a distal limb mass and you're not sure what it is, can you do a ring block above it where you're not actually touching the site with your, you know, with your method of administration? You're pretty far away from your surgical site. You're going to be far away from wherever you're going to potentially spread those cancer cells. I think that's a very fair chance, you know, to do a local block. It's going to be better for the patient, and you have a very low risk of spreading that. But if you're trying to do something where you're blocking at the site of where you're removing it, I do think that you do risk those things.
How many times a day do you search for drug information? 100? 200 times? Let's just say it's a lot. Each of those searches can be done in seconds with Plums. And you can trust that the information you find will be accurate and continually updated. And yes, that means no more waiting on the next edition. Plus, Plums has new tools like the Drug Interaction Checker, a first-of-its-kind clinical tool designed to help you make confident decisions when your patient's drug list gets long. See how Plums is trailblazing veterinary support at plums.com. So you talked about in your Greyhound case earlier that you were concerned you didn't want to have a hematoma formation, you know, when you gave that epidural. And that's one of the complications, you know, that we can see with administering local regional anesthesia. Other ones are, like we talked about a little bit earlier, inadvertent IV administration and peripheral nerve injury, and also just failure of your block. So let's talk about each of those a little bit more in depth. First off, what are some safeguards that we can do in clinic, our team can practice in order to protect against accidental IV administration of locals?
That's a great question. And in the article, I actually have a picture of a cefazolin dose for a patient and then the femoral sciatic dose of bupivacaine for that patient. And those two volumes are extremely similar. So similar that they're in the same size syringe. So I'm a big stickler on labels. So I do think that patient labels, but also drug labels should be on medications. And so in our hospital, we have a rule that every local block gets a bright pink sticker on it. You can't miss it. And it also has the drug stickers as well. So it'll say bupivacaine. I like to add dexmedetomidine to a lot of my blocks. So we'll have a dexmedetomidine sticker on there. And then on the needle itself, we'll put a patient label. So the needle cap will have a patient label on it so that when you go to take off that needle cap, it's something to say, hey, wait a second, does this go IV? You know, you see the pink sticker. Am I giving this in the right route, et cetera? Those are all safety mechanisms that we have in place to avoid those things. And they're pretty easy. You don't need special equipment for that. Everybody has patient stickers or a way to label patients. Everybody has white tape. You don't even need fancy labels. You can white tape and take a highlighter and highlight it. Like it doesn't have to be fancy. It just has to be consistent. So the other thing that people like to do is always do things in a certain order or leave the blocks in a certain place. So if we're doing epidurals, all the epidural stuff stays in the epidural cart. So nothing leaves the epidural cart unless it's going into the animal. And then the other easy thing to do is just to aspirate before you administer the block. If you aspirate, put a good amount of pressure on that, on that syringe, on your local anesthetic where you're going to give it, and make sure that you're not getting any blood that's flowing back into the syringe to avoid intravascular injection. And I do that every time. So if I'm doing multiple sites, if I'm doing a ring block and, you know, doing multiple sites, or if I'm doing multiple intercostal blocks, things like that, I aspirate every single time I go to inject that drug.
Yep. Or every time I redirect the needle, if I'm...
Yes, yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just an easy thing. It doesn't cost you any money. It costs you seconds and potentially saves several patients' lives. Have I aspirated and gotten blood back into my syringe? Absolutely. I will not lie to you. I will not tell you that that's never happened to me. I'm not perfect. So, and that just tells me, okay, I'm coming all the way out. We're starting over. We get fresh drug, fresh syringe, fresh needle. We just start all over again. And that's far easier than having to explain to a client, you know, something unfortunate happened to your animal.
Yeah, it honestly just happened to me the other day too, where I aspirated, and like you said, it's very rare that it happens, yep. But it surprised me, and I was like, oh, we have to stop.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, exactly. And when I have people helping me, when I'm doing ultrasound guided blocks, my, you know, technical staff, like they'll aspirate every single time that we do the ultrasound, you know, guided block, they look and they'll say, I can't see your needle hub. I'm not giving the drug. I can't see. Mm-hmm. And they're just as good, if not even better than I am at making sure that we're making the safest possible situation for that patient.
That's a great way that the whole team can get in on board.
Yes.
So let's talk about hematomas a little bit more. You obviously mentioned, you know, your greyhound on your Plavix. What are some other risks associated with hematoma formation?
So I've had hematoma formation that can cause pretty extensive bruising. One of the places that I would say it doesn't happen often, but I've had it happen a few times is like a brachial plexus block. I'll get a hematoma either from where I inserted my needle or coming out, I might nick a vessel or something like that. That can be a little bit uncomfortable for, you know, the client to say, why is my dog bruised all the way up on his shoulder when he had surgery on his elbow? You know, why? So explaining those things to clients can sometimes be a little bit more difficult. I would say clients get more upset about haircuts over anything else. So doing a block and having a weird haircut is honestly something I get more complaints about than anything else. So that's why we try to make it nice and neat and pretty, but it's still a haircut. And you can get hematoma formation that can also distort your surgical site, can distort your other anatomic landmarks. And so that's why I try to use smaller gauge needles. I like to use the nerve stimulator needles, even for my ultrasound guided blocks, because they're actually a little bit duller and they're more blunted. And they're less likely to directly puncture a vessel or lacerate a vessel when our hypodermic needles actually have a blade at the end of them. So we have to be careful about where we redirect those, how we redirect those, how aggressively we do that, and also the size of the needle. So I try to use smaller needles, smaller gauge needles in order to cause less trauma.
And that is a little bit too about not just the hematoma formation, but causing trauma or injury to the peripheral nerves. That can correct. Happen with the needles that you're talking about too, with the bladed edges, correct?
Correct. So, and that's, again, we have those nerve stimulator needles, and some of them actually come where they are more echogenic. So they're easier to see with ultrasound. So there are lots of different types, but the echogenic ones are nice, especially if you're just getting into ultrasound guided blocks. You can actually see the entire length of the needle a lot brighter on your ultrasound screen. And it makes it far easier to teach those blocks, but also ensure that you're in the right place, that your needle's in the correct plane to administer that block. They're not super expensive. They come in several different sizes, and we typically re-sterilize ours a couple times before we throw them away so that we can kind of get the most use out of that. We have kind of a, I guess, little train that you would say that, so we would, like, you know, flush them out, make sure there's no additional drug in there, and then we package them up and then put them through the gas sterilizer. And then use them again, you know, usually one or two times before we go ahead and throw them away. But if it's something infectious, if it's a patient that has, you know, overall a potential for having something that we aren't sure about, or if they, like, so for example, if they have lepto, but we have to go in, we had a dog with lepto, we had to take the gallbladder out. So I did a local regional block, but I was like, I know it's transmitted through the urine. I'm just, like, not going to take this risk. So I tossed that needle, for example. If I did a couple blocks on a dog with the same needle, I'm going to toss that needle after we're done, because we've used it a couple times and I don't want to, you know, have a super dull needle for the next patient.
And if general practitioners were, you know, interested in learning some of these more advanced techniques, is there a place that you would advise them to get some continuing education, or can you take a class in it?
So there's local block camp at Cornell. They do it's a lot of ultrasound guided local blocks. Mm-hmm. But there's lots of different, you know, continuing education, wet labs and so forth, not only at IVEX conferences, but also the ACVAA is going to be teaming up with ACVS this year. And so I know that at a lot of these conferences, we have wet labs on how to do certain things. You can actually even ask, like, I've gone to hospitals and taught people how to do simple local blocks, even up to more advanced local blocks, hospitals around my area. So a lot of anesthesiologists are actually willing to come and teach you things if you just ask. We're really happy to share our knowledge, and we love being able to provide pain management even outside of the patients that we get to interact with on a daily basis. So I think that the information is out there, and there's definitely both hands-on virtual learning or even in-person learning that you can do to kind of get your feet wet with this. If this is something you've always wanted to try, but weren't really sure if you had the materials or the experience or anything like right. that, almost every hospital has what you would need to get at least started in viewing local blocks for your patients, even if it's something as simple as we'll do a ring block for a toe amp and mm-hmm. or for, you know, any of these distal limb procedures, or even a coccygeal epidural for a mm-hmm. tail amputation. Just really
or
simple things
block
that,
cat.
Or block cat. I've had great success with block cat coccygeal blocks. And now mm-hmm. I have ER doctors that have learned how to do them in my hospital. And then they come to me, they're so happy. They're like, the cat was so easy to unblock now because mm-hmm. I did this coccygeal block. It took an extra 5 minutes, but it's totally worth it because I didn't spend as long unblocking the cat, you know? And then you have a less angry pet when he wakes up, like he's not as upset about his urinary catheter typically. So again, like, you know, we like to keep patients happy and comfortable, and that's how you can achieve that is with local anesthesia.
So one of the things that can happen though, when we're trying to, you know, do the best medicine, practice the best medicine, is that our block can fail. So what factors affect blockade failure?
So like we talked about before, the nerve cells need to be available and open for that local anesthetic to get into them. Things that change that are if the pH of the tissue is different. So if the pH is different, like so in an infected area, an area with a lot of swelling, cellulitis, things are going to change the typical tissue dynamics. That's actually going to change the efficacy of a local anesthetic because it can add or subtract hydrogen ions. It can change those charge balances. And so that makes it harder for those molecules to get inside the nerves in order to block them. Block failure can also happen if you don't use enough local anesthetic or you don't use enough volume to cover those three nodes of Ranvier that we talked about to actually fully block that nerve. So if you're if you're just trying to give a little bit of volume, you know, to either to save money or to save time, it may not be enough to block that entire, you know, area that you're looking for. So each type of block kind of has, associated volumes that we like to try to see with them. And so if you don't have enough local anesthetic to make that volume, diluting it with a little bit of saline, adding additional other drugs, you know, can also help increase the efficacy of that block.
And then if I'm concerned that my block has failed, what, you know, alternative options do I have? You know, I don't want to go back and do more local anesthetic if I'm concerned about toxicity. So right. How do I follow up from here?
Yeah, and that's a tough one. So I like to use local blocks to decrease how many systemic analgesics that we're using, just because some of their side effects can be pretty unsatisfying, especially to that patient. But sometimes you'll have to reach for something to either keep that patient comfortable while they're, you know, while they're in surgery. Sometimes you can maybe add additional analgesia on to your pain management protocol postoperatively. Whenever we can give an NSAID, I always like to try to give that NSAID, but maybe you'll have to add something like gabapentin on top of that, or even an oral opioid on top of that. If you're lucky enough for this to be a cat, then you can add something like tramadol, where mm-hmm. while it doesn't really work in dogs, it's phenomenal in cats. And again, their metabolism actually works to their favor this time. Since they can't metabolize anything, they actually keep that active metabolite of tramadol around, and it actually works great for them. So if you can get it down the cat, it's phenomenal. And so sometimes you'll just have to go ahead and reach for an additional mode of analgesia to add to your post-op plan in order to make that patient more comfortable. I've also had really good responses to a little bit of sub-Q ketamine to help prevent wind-up pain if I've had a block that hasn't worked. So a half a mg per kg of ketamine sub-Q isn't going to make your patient sleepy. It's not going to make them weird. It's not going to make them super high. But it has really helped prevent that wind-up pain in my clinical experience. There's like one paper out there that talks about mm-hmm. it. I'm sure there's a resident or two working on an amazing study that'll come out in a couple of years. But anecdotally, it works great and it's pretty inexpensive. And so I like to add that on if I'm worried my block didn't work super well.
And then the last complication that you discuss in the article and I'd like to talk about today is self-induced trauma. And so I find the place that I worry about this the most personally in general practice is with dental procedures, you know, so especially if we have to block the whole mouth, I'm very worried about self-trauma to the tongue, to the mouth. So obviously, you know, the type and extent of the trauma depends on where the block is. Like, is this truly a concern? How often does self-mutilation of the tongue really happen?
I'm not sure that I have a number for you in terms yeah. of self-mutilation of the tongue, but I will tell you that if you block both sides of the mandible, you know, due to a bilateral mandibular block, you will block the lingual nerve. And so they will not be able to feel their tongue. And so if they have any teeth left after this dental procedure, now, if you're doing a full mouth extraction, this may not matter, but if they have some teeth left to go ahead and bite on their tongue that they can't feel, they will bite it. And so they'll either bite it and cause a lot of bleeding, or some of them will bite it off. I don't think it happens very often because people have been, you know, warned about this. And so I do think that it is possible that if you have to do a lot of work on both sides of the bottom jaw, it might be beneficial to stage that patient. It does depend on how much work extensively you'll need to do between the two things. Now, is that a time where you're saying, okay, I have to do a ton of work on the left side, but not as much work on the right side? Do I put bupivacaine with a little buprenorphine in it on that left side to last pretty long, and then just use a teeny bit of Lido to like get them through on the right side so they can still feel their tongue in a couple hours when they wake up? If you can't anesthetize this patient again because they're a jerk in the hospital and you've talked to the owners about, you know, potential for complications, I think that that's a reasonable step to take. If you can stage it, it probably would be safer. The patient would be more comfortable. But I have blocked both sides of the mandible, but a lot of times that's ended up with patients that have their jaw kind of wired shut, mm-hmm. Or like methyl methacrylate to keep it kind of in one place, so the risk of chewing the tongue off is pretty low. Or full mouth extractions, again, would be another time where you're like, I don't have a lot to worry about there. So the likelihood of trauma is low. I've heard of patients that after an epidural have chewed at limbs, tail, etc. So again, the importance of watching your patient postoperatively, e-collar administration, and compliance with said e-collar. Even in the hospital, you'd be surprised at how difficult that can be sometimes. I know dogs with e-collars are annoying, but we have to make sure that we provide them the best care. So those are things that can happen. They're fairly infrequent, but it is a risk that you have to remind yourself of when you're administering local anesthesia.
And you had mentioned about, you know, maybe using a shorter acting local anesthetic on one side in the instance of blocking, you know, both sides of the mandible. So when the local, you know, wears off, obviously I assume the risk of this goes down.
Right.
Are there instances though where, you know, those behaviors could persist, like, you know, out days maybe after an epidural where an animal is still chewing at a leg or has, you know, persistent behavior where it seems like they can't feel?
So I have had blocks last longer than the reported timelines of blocks should be lasting. So I've had femoral sciatic blocks last upwards of 2 to 3 days. And that does seem to concern owners as they'll drag the leg and so forth. I haven't had one that's been a permanent problem. Eventually those things will go away as long as the nerve itself isn't damaged. That's another reason why when you're going to inject your local anesthetic, if you're getting any pressure, if you have a lot of pressure in order to inject that drug, you're probably too close or within that nerve sheath, and that can cause direct nerve damage. So I think that those kinds of complications that last days and days and days past the expected duration of the block are likely due to direct nerve injury by the administration of that local block. So I think that, again, you have to have a little bit of, you know, awareness of those types of things when you're administering that. So if you get a lot of pressure back in your syringe when you're trying to just inject local anesthetic into an area, is that because, you know, are you in the nerve? Should you redirect? Should you kind of readjust your needle a little bit? And so you get a little bit less pressure and therefore you're less likely to damage the nerve. Absolutely. They've determined that high pressure block administration is the most likely thing that is going to cause long lasting nerve damage.
That's a really good tip. So this conversation has really given me a lot more confidence that I could, you know, recognize and manage some of these possible adverse events. So I'm really happy that you were able to sit down and talk with me today. Before I let you go, there is a little game that we like to play at the end of our episodes. it's just for fun. It's a series of kind of would you rather questions. There's no right or wrong answer. It's just,
okay.
Yeah, let's get started.
Okay.
So first off, would you rather learn a new skill every single year or hone one skill and become the best in the whole world at that one thing?
Oh, I'd much rather learn something new every single year.
Yeah.
It'd be way more fun.
This one's going to be a hard one for you. Would you rather practice without gas anesthetics or without local anesthetics?
Without gas all day.
All day. Oh, wow. I thought that'd be harder.
Nope, without gas. I have a new theory on brachycephalic anesthesia, and it revolves around only using Teva. And so far it's working great. So I will go without gas all day. Yeah. It's our biggest problem in anesthesia right now, and it's our biggest cause of hypotension. Nope. Give me local anesthetics and no gas.
Okay. So if they were both still alive, would you rather anesthetize a woolly mammoth or a stegosaurus?
Oh, that's a great question. Probably a stegosaurus because it's closest to a dragon. And I was really into Game of Thrones when I was studying for boards. And so my study buddy and I would like joke about how we would anesthetize a dragon and how you'd combat like the fire coming out of their mouth and like administering oxygen. So we had a lot to think about,
keep
right?
That question.
Yeah. Like a stegosaurus is more difficult, right? What do you do for positioning? Right. What do you do for how do you like, can you put the art line in the tail? Like, I want to know all these things. So no, definitely a stegosaurus for sure.
Okay. If you had to pick one, would you rather redo your veterinary medical residency or would you rather go back to high school?
Oh gosh, that's a terrible question. I guess I would go, oh, that's hard. I think I would go back to high school. My residency was tough. I was on call a lot. I like barely slept. So no, I'd go back to high school, I guess. Yeah.
All right. And last question. Would you rather have a crystal ball that could diagnose any condition, but then you'd have to treat it, you'd have to fix it? Or would you rather have a magic wand that could fix anything, but you have to figure out exactly what's wrong first?
That's also difficult. I think I'd rather be able to, because a crystal ball, if you know what's wrong, there's not always a solution for it. But if I can fix something by finding out what's wrong, I'm a problem solver. So I think I'd rather the magic wand.
I think I'd rather have the magic wand too.
Yeah.
Well, that was great. You did one fantastic. That was all my questions.
Thank you.
Thanks again for joining us today, Dr. Bennett. This was a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. This was awesome. And I hope everybody got to learn a little something today.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review us. You can also listen to our podcast on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Clinicians Brief and on Instagram at clinicians.brief. Or drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief the Podcast is a Brief Media production produced by Alexis Ussery, sound by Randall Stupka, and hosted by me, Dr. Alyssa Watson.